Today's broadcast was originally recorded on June 13th, 2023.
It's a very happy one, at least for some of us.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF, amongst other fine terrestrial affiliates. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and many, if not most, of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another, if you will, special edition of the Bradcast. Glad to have you here. Happy Arraignment Day, or perhaps I should say happy birthday to our former president, who, as you heard at the top there, right-wing activist Laura Loomer singing off-key for him while wearing a Donald Trump Did Nothing Wrong t-shirt as one of a circus-like smattering of supporters and protesters and observers outside the federal courthouse in Miami on Tuesday, as Donald J. Trump actually turns 76 years old on Wednesday. Desi Doyen, I can't think of a better way to celebrate that milestone. Can you?
Happy birthday, Donald Trump.
At least for those who believe in, you know, accountability and the rule of law, in any case, I can't think of a better way to celebrate. For him to be arraigned on 37 new criminal counts in federal court, making him the first president in U.S. history to be charged with any felony crimes, and at the federal level, I'm bringing his total number of criminal felony counts now to 71, with 34 charged in New York State just over 2 months ago, and another 37 brought by 23 South Florida residents last week in the investigation by Special Counsel Jack Smith, for which the former disgraced president was arraigned at the federal courthouse in Miami on Tuesday. So, indeed, happy birthday, Mr. President. May you have many years to life ahead of you. A reportedly glum and seemingly irritated former President Donald Trump became the first former president to face a judge on federal charges as his attorney pleaded not guilty on his behalf in that Miami courtroom on Tuesday to dozens of felony counts that he hoarded classified documents and refused repeated government demands to give them back. The history-making arraignment, as AP reports, now kickstarts a legal process that will unfold at the height of the 2024 presidential campaign and carry profound consequences not only for his political future, but more urgently for his own personal liberty. As former federal prosecutor Dennis Aftergut, now of counsel to Lawyers Defending American Democracy, told Salon this week, Trump is now in, quote, extreme peril. The narrative here is one of betrayal of a nation and its most precious secrets by a man who was the commander-in-chief for 4 years and who seeks that mantle again. There has never been anything remotely like it, writes Aftergut. The disregard for the lives, the risk, and the individual courage that goes into gathering information vital to our national security and our safety is incomprehensible. He writes, there is no way for the brain to wrap itself around what is described in this indictment. The violation of sacred trust, a one-man demolition crew working against the American intelligence system that has been built brick by brick over 80 years. With the kind of conduct alleged in the indictment, he says, by the former occupant of the highest office in the land, how is any foreign intelligence service supposed to trust us to keep information confidential, to protect its methods of collecting our enemy's secrets or the identity of its sources? It could take years, he says, if not decades, to recover from the damage. This from an email exchange with Salon's executive editor, Andrew O'Hare. Put together three basic pieces, he continues. One, the bone-chilling nature of the materials unlawfully taken from the White House. Two, the apparent exposure of those materials at Mar-a-Lago. And three, what we know from public reporting about security there and our nation's enemies whose agents may have breached it. First, 31 documents have what are called compartmentalized top secret markings. Compartmentalized, he notes, means information about certain intelligence sources and methods. Top secret signifies information that would cause, if revealed, exceptionally grave harm to the nation's security. Compartmentalized top secret documents are kept in secure structures, or SCIFs, the fortified rooms that protect against electronic surveillance or other efforts by outside parties to obtain the information. Examples on the list of materials that Donald Trump took to Mar-a-Lago include documents, quote, concerning nuclear weaponry of the United States, nuclear capabilities of a foreign country, which could be North Korea or Russia or China or Iran, we just don't know, he says. The materials Trump possessed at his resort home include documents, quote, concerning military attacks by a foreign country, timeline and details of attack on a foreign country, and military contingency planning of the United States. These are materials that almost anyone hostile to the interests of the United States would love to get their hands on, he notes, which is why they should never be held at easily penetrated places like Mar-a-Lago. Second, he says, the indictment describes and indeed shows via an abundance of photographs, boxes of documents stacked in exposed locations, a ballroom stage, a bathroom shower, and in one instance, a secret document concerning military capabilities of a foreign country, according to the indictment, that had spilled out of its box and onto the floor in a storage room. Third, notes Aftergut, public reporting shows that in March 2019, a Chinese national was arrested at Mar-a-Lago carrying four cell phones and a computer thumb drive with computer malware on it. When detained, she claimed to be there to attend a non-existent event in her hotel room where, quote, 9 thumb drives, 5 SIM cards for cell phones, and a device used to detect hidden cameras. In 2021 and 2022, a Ukrainian-born woman infiltrated Mar-a-Lago multiple times using the false name Anita Rothschild. She was even photographed with Trump on the golf course and was reportedly associated with a Russian oligarch who lives in Florida. These incidents are, in all likelihood, the tip of the iceberg, writes Aftergut. Objectively, the Espionage Act charges look virtually open and shut, he argues. 31 counts alleging that Trump willfully retained defense-related materials that he possessed without authorization. But of course, that's not all, as Aftergut describes some of the other charges, including the indictment as well, such as the separate charge of conspiracy to obstruct the grand jury's investigation, where the government has Trump's lawyer, Evan Corcoran's court-ordered grand jury testimony and notes, and allege that after the May 22 grand jury subpoena last year compelling Trump to return all classified documents a full year after he left office, and after the National Archives had repeatedly requested nicely that he do so, Trump was documented as having said to Corcoran, quote, "Wouldn't it be better if we just told them we didn't have anything here?" And then, quote, "Well, look, isn't it better if there are no documents?" That was just two of the incidents that prosecutors allege reveal the former president asking his own attorneys to commit high crimes on his behalf. As to the penalties that this former federal prosecutor believes the current federal prosecutors will seek, quote, "The crimes alleged are so serious, so damaging to the security and welfare of the United States that prosecutors' obligation, should there be convictions, would be to ask for the maximum term of imprisonment available. The culpability of a former commander-in-chief who betrays his nation, they would say, requires nothing less." Of course, the maximum term, should Trump be found guilty on all charges, would be some 420 years for the crimes with which he was charged. Legal analysts say that number would more likely be something like 22 years just for the Espionage Act charges alone. So, happy 76th birthday, and happy second arraignment day, and happy overdue accountability day to those of us who have long believed in the rule of law and accountability, even for the most powerful people in these United States. Joining us now to celebrate and or help us make sense of it all on another historic day, of course, Desi Doyen is here as always with her birthday hat on, I should add. Hello, Des. We're also joined for special coverage today by a panel of two friends of this program, of course, as on all special Donald Trump days. From the day he came down the golden escalator, we are joined by Heather Digby Parton, long known simply as Digby on her long-running Hullabaloo blog and as a regular award-winning columnist at Salon.com. Welcome back, Heather, and happy Arraignment Day to you.
Same to you. Happy Arraignment Day, everyone.
And we're also happy to be joined by former attorney and Republican from Florida, who still lives in the GOP enclave of the Villages in the Sunshine State. That would be Keith Barber, otherwise known as the longtime, very popular Daily Coast columnist Keith DB. Oh, Keith, welcome back to the broadcast, counselor.
Well, thank you, Brad, and I am marking myself as safe from South Florida arraignment.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it goes after this show, Keith. Stay safe down there. Heather, let me start with you. I know a lot of our listeners felt that Donald Trump would never be charged with anything, certainly not at the federal level, as that, you know, has really been the historic pattern for obviously criminal U.S. presidents over the past 50 years or so. Many Democrats were very critical of Attorney General Merrick Garland. Have those concerns from Democrats been largely wiped away by this indictment? Or will that depend on how Jack Smith comes in on the January 6th case, if he decides to bring indictments there?
Well, I think this does allay a lot of the concerns that people had, that somehow or another the DOJ was going to be too, and Jack Smith as the special counsel was, you know, going to be too reluctant to get into this mess, which mm-hmm. of course it is, on both a political and a legal level, and maybe figure it wasn't worth it, let the voters decide, you know, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, I do think that the January 6th case is super, super important, and, you know, depending on the evidence that they are turning up with all these, with this long-running grand jury investigation that they have going on, I am very hopeful that if that evidence is there, that they, you know, do bring the charges on that particular case, mm-hmm. because that one is very, very serious. I mean, that was an attempt to, you know, obstruct the peaceful transfer of power, and, you know, you just, that goes way beyond any kind of, you know, even the severity mm-hmm. in terms of this national security case in Florida that one goes right, you know, directly to the heart of our democracy. So, I don't know if Democrats are upset about it. I feel pretty good today myself.
Do you think that the charges in that case are more or less likely to come based on what we've learned about Jack Smith through the indictment in the stolen documents case?
He seems to be pretty serious about going after this, and you know, it all depends. That's a much different case, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a really, really complicated kind of concept to get into. You know, whether or not there was some kind of a conspiracy and be able to prove that, and you know, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to guess on how difficult that is. But it just seems to me, on the face of it, that that is a much different kind of case than what we're dealing with in Florida, which looks to be pretty open and shut, if you ask me, as an avid viewer of Law and Order.
Well, you know, I was both surprised and not surprised by the indictment in the stolen documents case. Heather, I knew what he did, but I was still rather stunned to sort of see it spelled out in such breathtaking detail with 37 counts. You know, as someone else who I know has been calling for accountability, you and I have been talking about it on the radio and on the blogs for, you know, decades now, you know, calling for accountability for these past presidents. What was your reaction when these charges were unsealed late last week?
Yeah, I was pretty stunned as well. I mean, I don't see how anybody could not be stunned by what they saw. I mean, we knew what he'd done. We knew he had the documents. We knew they found them. We knew that he had dragged his feet and that he was making all kinds of excuses. But the detail in this indictment about what the documents were, where they were kept, how he behaved, and of course all this stuff with the attorney-client privilege, you know, with what he was trying to, but what he thought he was saying to his privileged attorney there, was pretty shocking stuff. I mean, I'll be curious to hear from Keith what he thinks about that, because that seems to be one of the big issues in the case that will probably come up. They're already signaling that that's going to be one of the big bases for, you know, or the big basis of their defense, to try and disqualify, at the very least, you know, some of the attorneys for, you know, some kind of misconduct, and also to challenge these rulings on the attorney-client privilege being breached. So that shocked me, and I'm sure it shocked an awful lot of other people.
Let's talk about some of Donald Trump's attorney problems. Keith Barber, one of the biggest problems, and I'm going to actually put that word in air quotes for a moment. One of the biggest problems that Trump seems to be having is even finding an attorney, much less a team of attorneys, to defend against, you know, the very serious charges in the stolen documents case. That after he fired two of his own attorneys the day after he was indicted last week, on the heels of firing yet another one, Tim Parlatore, a week or so earlier, and another one of his attorneys, Evan Corcoran, is likely to be a star witness against him in this case, after documents show that Trump had actually asked Corcoran to commit crimes on his behalf, you know, by making documents disappear. But Keith, is that a problem actually for Trump, or is it a benefit? In other words, will his difficulties in finding an attorney, you know, willing to represent him and able to represent him, because they have to be read in on top secret documents, will that actually help delay his case in Florida? And isn't that what he's after anyway?
Yeah, it certainly could. I think that Trump's attorneys, the new attorneys, of course, players to be designated, will certainly seek to exclude the testimony and the documents, for example, that were used in the indictment for Evan Corcoran. And you already have a judicial determination that those documents, were not protected by attorney-client privilege because of the crime fraud exception. But that's likely to get, you know, a second review for trial, and it'll be, you know, under Judge Luce Cannon, who's known to be much more sympathetic to Donald Trump. So we'll, you know, but it'll be one of the things that will delay things in this process. Motion in limines, as they're called, to exclude evidence, are common. They're common in criminal trials, but I think Trump's attorneys will just throw everything at this. They're going to argue that the search warrant was illegal too, and it was overbroad, and so the evidence seized in the search warrant can't be used either. None of those should succeed, mind you, but it's going to be a way to stall things, and if Judge Cannon issues as rogue a decision as she's already done in this case involves Trump, then the government will be compelled to appeal, and that will take more time too.
And does Trump actually have the right to argue or try to argue that, hey, I'm having trouble finding an attorney. I got to get a very specialized attorney who's been, you know, read in and with security clearances to even look at these documents in question. Is that an argument that he can make and play out over time? And would a normal judge who wasn't Eileen Cannon, you know, say, well, if you're having trouble, Mr. Trump, we can appoint a public attorney, a public defender for you?
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. There isn't going to be a public defender with security clearance. But the court could appoint an attorney, but I don't think that's going to happen either. I think that the judge will be tolerant to some degrees, and I think that that's something that Judge Cannon can probably get away with, is being tolerant of that sort of argument of, look, I'm having a hard time finding counsel that can look at all of this incredibly sensitive stuff. You talked about it. It's unreal. It's stuff so classified that its classifications were redacted from the indictment. It's that classified.
Right. So in general, I know you wrote about this at Medium and at Daily Kos, describing the indictment as, quote, amazing, with, quote, evidence and charges so sprawling and impacting, I barely know where to start. Tell me quickly about your initial general reaction as an attorney to these
indictments. My initial general reaction was, I'm going to write an article about this. And as I started reviewing it, I realized that while, only 48 or so pages long, that it would be hard to summarize. Because, man, there's not a wasted word in that indictment. You can't skip over stuff or anything like that. So it's hard to wrap it up. Everything in it is gold.
Yeah.
In terms of how impactful it is, from the pictures to the description of the nature of the classified documents involved, to these conversations that Trump had with his attorneys, which... I got to wonder about that. If I'm having a conversation with a client that goes like some of those is, at some point I have to say, time out. We can't be talking like this.
Right. Yeah, and when he's clearly asking him to commit crimes, what would be the proper way, what would have been, I guess, the proper way for Evan Corcoran when he was clearly being asked to do things he shouldn't have been asked? How should he have responded at that point?
Wouldn't it be better if we just told them that if we don't have anything here, as you pointed out, was one of the questions, and then the next one mentioned was, look, isn't it better if there are no documents? And you just have to stop the conversation then. Sir, you're asking me to be involved in this crime, and that does two things. It creates a potential conspiracy. And another thing it does is it has the potential to, as it eventually did, break our attorney-client privilege. And you have to tell the client that. The answer to your questions are no. And the only correct answer is we have to respond to the complete subpoena completely. And apparently Corcoran did get around to saying that, but Trump nonetheless worked around him to hide the documents. But you have to, when a client starts discussing illegal conduct with you, the conversation needs to end before he finishes the sentence. And the client has to be advised, look, we can't be having a discussion like this.
And somehow Evan Corcoran is still currently, anyway, not only going to be a star witness in this case on this trajectory we're on, but he's also still serving as his actual lawyer, as I understand it, on, I think, the is it the New York case or the January 6th case? I don't.
Yeah, know. I don't see how that can last.
I don't either, Heather. The question that still seems to have no definitive answer. So let me put it to you. Why did Trump do it? He was given opportunity after opportunity to simply return the documents for like a year and a half. The National Archives was begging him to just, sir, please give us back the documents. He would have been completely off the hook. Nobody would have ever known about it. Why didn't he do it? Is it that, as many are saying, oh, he thought these documents were his? Or is there something more nefarious at work here? Like, you know, he had already maybe given some away or sold them or couldn't give them back. Are we any closer to having an answer to that question?
I don't think we're any closer to having that answer. It goes back to the very beginning of Donald Trump's term. We have spent hours just on this show alone just trying to figure out what motivates him to do the things that he does. For instance, his you know, incredible affinity for dictators, particularly Vladimir Putin. I mean, what was that about? And we talked forever about were their financial interests? Did they have something on him? Was it ego? Was it that he was being flattered? You know, what makes him tick? What makes him do what he does? And I don't think we know in this case. Although maybe we'll find out if there's more evidence. A lot of the attorneys on TV, anyway, are saying, you know, look, that not everything is in this indictment. There's other evidence out there, so maybe we'll find something about motive. I'm sure they'd love to have one if they are presenting this case. But one of the things we do know, you know, setting aside all the psychological stuff, which we can go on about for days, about, you know, how he's a narcissist and he's, you know, got all kinds of weird psychological problems, and we know that, as which explains, you know, maybe why he would keep them, and they're mine, and, you know, this is, you don't have a right to look at my stuff.
It doesn't explain for a year and a half. That
I know, there are some other possibilities here. For instance, there's a whole lot of money that's flowing back and forth between, the Saudi Arabian government and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. He's got this interest in this golf club. He was also, and this is one that I really think that people should think about, he was running for president from the moment he left the White House on January 20th, 2021. He always knew he was going to be running, and he had in his possession information that would be useful. We know that he would be more than willing to use it to help him get elected. He did it. He got impeached for doing that. He got impeached for saying to the Ukrainian president, you know, I'd like you to do me a favor, though. He said, I'd like you to do me a favor, though. So he had all these documents saying God knows what. I mean, we don't know what the specifics are in them. They're very valuable and could be very useful to him in trying to leverage a little help from his friends.
Yeah, and, you know, I got to say, over the last few days, the words, again, are sort of ringing in my brain. I remember Adam Schiff wrapping up the first impeachment trial saying, you know, if he did it before, if he's not held accountable, he will do it again. And he has done it again in spades, Keith.
Hey, Brad, let me take a stab at the motive thing. Because I think, for starters, you know, how many crimes have you heard of where, you know, somebody does something completely just doesn't make sense at all, and you're like, what were they thinking? And there's a tendency to want to rationalize what was simply irrational. And if you're looking for a rational explanation of what Trump did, there just may not be one. It's just irrational, and you can't get a rational answer. But look at what he did with one of the documents. And it kind of goes to what Heather was talking about. He took this document that involved the war plan from General Milley about invading Iran, and he showed it to this writer in order to show that Milley was wrong about Trump. Milley said that Trump wanted to go to war against Iran, and Trump thinks this document shows that it wasn't Trump that wanted to do that, but that it was Milley that wanted to do that.
Right.
And I don't think that the document really does that, but that's what's in Trump's head is, hey, I can use this to get back at people who said bad things about me, like General Milley in this case. And that's how he used that document, very sensitive document, in front of a writer.
Yeah, which makes sense, again, for the first few months. But, you know, and I guess that was like July of 2022. So, July 2022. So that was already a year and a half or so, I think, after, unless it was July 21, I can't remember. But it makes sense initially, the thinking. But, you know, once a year goes by, they're asking you to give it back. Once a subpoena from the Department of Justice comes in and you're still refusing it, at that point, I got to wonder what could possibly be on his brain.
Well, and you're right. It was July 2021.
Yeah.
Which is in the middle of the negotiations. That's
a whole year later.
Yeah.
And if he had turned over these documents and that document at that time, we would not be here now.
Correct.
Yeah, we wouldn't know about any of this stuff. We wouldn't know about the boxes stored in a public bathroom or on a ballroom stage where thousands of people went by. We'd know none of this. I think that, to your point, Brad, though, I think that it could be all of the above. You know, he could use them for revenge and retaliation against his perceived enemies. He could use it because it offers him an opportunity to make some money and gain some power and gain some leverage by, as Heather mentioned, going to his foreign friends for a little help when he needs it. And also, I would like to add, don't forget about Jared Kushner, because everyone remembers that a few months after leaving the White House, he received $2 billion from Saudi Arabia, and the timing was just so convenient with the Saudi Arabia golf tournament, the LIV golf tournament at the Bedminster Trump Golf Resort, and all of these things moving together at the same time. I think it could be all of the above.
You're such a conspiracy theorist. Not that the guy has now been charged with conspiracy, but in any event, I need to get to a break, but I want to sort of get to 2 points here before we do. Keith Barber, if you were Trump's attorney right now, since you are, as I understand it, an available attorney in Florida and a longtime...
I am not licensed and never was licensed.
Aw, too bad.
And a longtime Republican. That's okay. They're taking people who aren't licensed in Florida. Don't worry about it. If you were his attorney right now, what would you recommend to him as your client right about now?
Well, if his name wasn't Trump, I'd be trying to convince him to accept a plea deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is such a slam dunk. Now, there's a lot of complications with that because his name is Trump.
Mm-hmm.
To include that, Trump thinks that if he gets elected, or for that matter, if any Republican gets elected in 2024, that he'll be pardoned for this.
Mm-hmm. But not for the state charges, and so
he'll be given a pardon for this case because these are federal charges.
Right.
That's what Trump believes that.
Well,
and he believes that he can pardon himself, and whether he can or not is something that's a kind of a wide open question there, and I don't know. But there'd be no doubt that if another Republican, you know, became president in 2024, that president can pardon Trump. So I think that a lot of the calculus involved in this is to try and drag this out until after the election, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if I was Trump's attorney, that would be my strategy. Drag this mm-hmm. out until after the election, hope that a Republican wins, and then get a pardon.
I'm not an attorney, but I would tell him to beg for a plea deal to avoid jail time, promise to never run for public office again, which is probably the only way that he could, ever get such a deal, it seems to me. Maybe take some home confinement, pay a large fine, but he can't really do that, at least for the moment, because it's not just this one case. There are all of these other cases in which he also faces jail time. Heather, is there any chance that Trump tries to cop a plea deal and by the way, that the DOJ would accept such a deal?
Well, I think the DOJ would probably accept a deal, depending on the terms, of course, you know, obviously. But there's not a chance in a million years that he will take a plea deal. He is not going to do that. I think that's completely off the table. It will not happen in any of these cases. I mean, I suppose it's theoretically possible that he could cop maybe to the Manhattan case and say, yeah, you know, and just sort of he could get off with sort of, you know, halfway saying, yeah, I did it, but, you know, I was just trying to save my marriage or something, and, you know, takes a plea on that one. But I can't imagine him doing it on any of the election stuff or this national security stuff, because that is just, that is central to his psyche at this point. It's a, his entire world is organized around this. And I don't think he would do it. I really don't.
Heather, before we get to a break here, so sorry to ask you a big question with a little time to answer it. But we opened the phones up on the show yesterday to listeners. And the only defense, if you can even call it that, from Trump supporters was that other people like Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton did the exact same thing that Trump did, but they weren't charged. Now, when Joe Biden's attorneys discovered that he had some old classified documents, they immediately invited the DOJ to come in, do a search, take them all away. So it is not a similar case. But you wrote about the comparison to Hillary Clinton's case at Salon yesterday. Can you quickly sort of rebut the case that, you know, Hillary did it too, and even as Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin actually claimed on Fox News on Sunday, Trump chose not to prosecute Hillary Clinton for it, and Joe Biden should have done the same.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can do that, and I think I can do it fairly quickly. Although I could go into it in depth, but I won't. There were five.
You might have to. This is going to go on for a while, but anyway, go ahead.
It'll happen. Yeah, it'll be required again.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were five investigations into the Clinton email server thing, and I'm not counting the Benghazi stuff, which was also part of the email server.
Mm-hmm.
There was the FBI, original FBI investigation. There was an inspector general, DOJ inspector general's investigation. There were two State Department investigations, and Bill Barr himself, under pressure from Donald Trump and his little boy toy Matt Whitaker at the time, actually, Bill Barr named a U.S. attorney in Utah to also look into all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They all concluded the same thing. Hillary Clinton didn't break any laws with this. I mean, everybody acknowledges that you shouldn't have had the server, but there were no laws broken here. I'm not even talking about the obstruction part, which, of course, she did not do. She cooperated with the government, of course. But also the actual substance of the charge, the classified documents in question had not been labeled classified at the time they flowed through the email server, and there were no markings on them, and they were, you know, sort of minor low-level kind of, you know, which were later classified after the fact. So the facts of the case don't match at all on the Clinton thing, absolutely don't match at all. The second thing is that, you know, if you look at Joe Biden, I'll just take a minute to talk about him. There's no question that, number one, he is the president as we speak. So he could go and declassify them all in his mind right now,
right.
if that's what he wanted to do,
right.
And he could do it. But he, you know, there's no question that he took them willfully, or that he, you know, and certainly that he didn't keep them, which is one of the big charges in the Trump case. So all of this is nonsense. It's whataboutism. It's, of course, what they would do. You know, and there are a million cases of poor schmucks that worked in the government that, you know, did much less than anything that Trump did. Much, much, you know, lesser kinds of offenses that they did that actually went to jail. So this is all nonsense.
And I keep, every time this comes up, I keep thinking of Reality Winner, who tried to warn about what Russia, their interference in the 2016 election. One single document was sentenced to 5 years and 3 months for one document. This guy stole hundreds, if not thousands. All right, we got to take a quick break here. It is our arraignment day special coverage, the second arraignment day special coverage with Heather Digby Parton and Keith Barber. And we, Desi Doyen will be with us for a Green News Report as well a little bit later on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang, that's the sound of the men working on the chain.
gang all day long they're saying.
A boy can dream, can't he? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Special coverage of Donald Trump's second felony arraignment, his first federal felony arraignment on 37 counts in Miami at the courthouse on Tuesday, speaking with our special guests, Heather Digby Parton and of Salon and Hullabaloo, and attorney, former attorney, now in Florida, Keith Barber of Daily Kos. Keith, you made a point over the break there in response to the point that
the both sidesism about Biden
and yeah, folks claiming that Joe Biden did the same thing that Donald Trump did and he didn't get arrested, unlike Trump. You had a good point on that.
And of course, they say so they should be treated the same. Mm-hmm. And I say, fine, let's treat them the same. Donald Trump was not charged for anything related to any of the documents that he voluntarily returned.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to treat them similarly, then Biden should not be charged for any documents that he voluntarily returned. It's simple. And that's what's going to happen.
Yep. Good. Excellent point. Keith, let me ask you, we talked a little bit earlier about Eileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed U.S. District Court judge who's currently set to oversee this case. There's been a lot of back and forth on this one. She had her last brush with this case, of course, completely tossed out by the very conservative 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. It included two Trump-appointed judges who basically found that she actually interfered with the case in her orders barring the FBI from continuing their investigation until a special master reviewed the seized documents. But it's unclear to me, and I don't know if it's any clearer to you, will she remain on this case? You've already suggested she will be a problem for the prosecution if so, but this circuit is supposed to be, you know, a so-called rocket docket that moves very quickly in the Southern District of Florida. So will she remain on the case and will she be able to hold it up even though it's a supposed rocket docket down there?
That's a really good question. And, you know, the 11th Circuit with those two Trump-appointed judges used the phrase, in regards to her, mm-hmm. abuse of discretion.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty strong phrase coming from judges that should be friendly to you, and they were not.
Mm.
We've now got a case where a judge is hearing the matter where it's been documented judicially that she has already abused her discretion previously in this case. Is that enough to get her involuntarily recused? I mean, in my view, she should voluntarily recuse, but I don't believe she will.
Mm.
The standard for a compelled recusal is very high. I don't think it is met yet. It's certainly not frivolous for the Department of Justice to ask for it.
Uh-huh.
And it might be a little bit of a close call, but I don't think it's there yet. It usually requires repeated instances of demonstration of such favoritism or bias. And we have a sample size of one. And so Cannon gets to argue a single data point does not a trend establish. And on the other hand, if other data points get added by decisions she makes in this case, certainly what she has already done may put her on a short leash.
Heather, based on what we know about this woman, based on her decisions in the earlier part of this, late last year, if I were her, she took such a beating from the appellate court from, as Keith says, you know, judges that should have been on her side in this. She has the ability, I think, to voluntarily recuse, as Keith suggests. Is there any chance she would do that? I think I would rather than sit at the center of the biggest, the most explosive case ever after so royally screwing it up just months ago.
Well, it would depend on whether or not she identifies, you know, within her own mind as, you know, a serious jurist, someone who, you know, sees a full career ahead of her as a judge and wants to be taken seriously, maybe be promoted, you know, up higher, or whether or not she identifies as a MAGA kind of, you know, Trump person. Mm-hmm. And her rulings in the early case, you know, could very easily indicate that she's the latter, that she is someone who actually sees herself more as, you know, an activist than an actual, you know, than an actual jurist. So I don't know. I mean, I guess it's theoretically possible. But, you know, when you consider, I mean, there are people like, you know, like the judge down in Texas who did the abortion ruling recently.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of people like that in the judicial system now. And she is a Trump appointee. So it's entirely possible that she sees this as an opportunity to do, you know, God's work as an activist judge, you know, standing up for, you know, Donald Trump's right to be president, I guess, right to get away with murder. I mean, that does seem to be something that, I mean, look at some of these, you know, politicians. I mean, they're not all just cowards who are afraid to say the truth. There are a lot of them who actually believe this stuff that they're saying.
And
so, you know, I think it's going to be, I don't think there's cause for optimism on this. I mean, maybe we should wait and see what happens, but I doubt I am not ready to take what some of these people, you know, on television are going, well, it's the law, it's the majesty of the judicial system, and, you know, she'll be serious, and the jury will be serious, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I hope so. But I wouldn't bank on it at this point, not after what we've already seen her do.
Very quickly, guys, let me start. Keith, do we know, can a former president actually, well, I think they can be sentenced to jail, but aren't there problems with a former president actually serving time in prison with, you know, a lifetime Secret Service detail, et cetera?
Yeah, that hits it right there. The guy is entitled by law Secret Service protection for life, so, you know, you can't jail his Secret Service agents. I kind of feel like we're just going to have to cross that bridge when we get to it. I don't know what the answer is to that. I certainly think that he deserves jail, and if we're going to be a nation driven by the rule of law, that he should be jailed. I would like to see how that gets done, or constructive answers as to how it could be done. You know, maybe one answer is you change the law to address this particular situation.
We may well see how it is done in the months ahead. Let me go quickly around the table for sort of a one-word unfair question for each of you guys. Which indictment comes next? Jack Smith's January 6th conspiracy case or Fulton County District Attorney's Fannie Willis's election theft conspiracy case in Georgia? Keith, which one comes next?
Well, it's interesting because January 6th has the potential to involve other defendants and maybe not even indict Trump. So, you could have guys like Eastman and Giuliani and so forth indicted in that investigation, and Smith may just give Trump a pass. Don't know.
Heather,
that's more than a word.
I think Willis is next.
You think Willis is next. Heather, you want to ring in real quick?
I'd guess that, too, because we know that she's coming in August, and I don't know that the January 6th case is that far along.
Okay, I'll
And Brad, watch for the possibility that all of these other cases get put in hold, pause button, while the federal case plays out.
Hope
Tish
that's
James
not the
actually
case.
Said that today, by the way, that it might happen.
Tish James, New York Attorney General.
Des, you got a thought on it before we get out?
My prediction, since everybody else is going with Willis, I'll go ahead and go with Jack Smith and the J6. And I just want to point out also, I find it obscene that Republican politicians are still supporting Trump, and I think we need to talk about that at some point.
Oh, I'm sure we'll have time for that as well, as we will to talk to both of these guys in the days ahead. By the way, breaking news, a judge will let E. Jean Carroll amend her defamation lawsuit to seek more damages against Trump for the comments he made at a CNN town hall about her the day after he was fined some $5 million for sexual abuse and defamation against her.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
never learned to show shut his pie hole.
The fun continues. That was Heather Digby Parton's pie hole. You can find her at salon.com and digbysblog.net. Also on the Twitters at Digby56. And Keith Barber can be found over at dailycoast.com. He writes as Keith DB over there. And you can find him on the Twitter. He's got a great Twitter feed at KeithDB80. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate both of you joining us today.
Thanks, Brad.
Have a good one, Brad.
Thanks, guys. All right, we got to take a quick break, and we are back. We're not done. We still have Desi Doyen and her latest Green News Report. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Okay. Neither rain, nor heat, nor sleet, nor snow, nor Trump indictment special coverage will keep Desi from her appointed rounds on our latest Green News Report.
With regards to the complete rebuild of I-95 roadway, we expect that to take some number of months.
Gas tanker fire leads to collapse of major freeway overpass.
There are likely farms in every state that are knowingly or unknowingly dealing with these chemicals.
Three manufacturers agree to $1 billion settlement as states sue over PFAS chemicals in drinking water. Plus,
researchers say the latest event is gaining strength and could lead to record-breaking temperatures next year.
Buckle up. El Nino is here to intensify extreme weather around the world.
Oh, great. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There's little question that Canada needs to obviously focus on forest management, but this isn't the moment to start lecturing people about the science of climate change. Right now it's about putting out a fire and keeping people safe.
The moment when New York Congressman Mark Molinaro figured out how to recycle gun safety denialism for climate change. This is your Green News Report. All right, Desi Doyen, as fires continue to rage in Canada, you've got great news about El Nino.
Yes, unfortunately, El Nino has officially arrived. The naturally occurring periodic warm pattern in the Pacific Ocean that gooses global temperatures is expected to strengthen over the winter, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Forecasters warn that this El Nino occurs on top of record warm ocean temperatures, which will combine to intensify extreme weather around the world. Storms, droughts, deadly heat waves, you name it, that are already worsening from human-caused climate change.
I'd rather not name it. The last year or so, we had some record heat, even though there was a La Nina, which is supposed to cool things, right?
Uh-huh.
And now we're going to have an El Nino.
Making it even hotter. Yes.
Fantastic.
And it's likely that 2023 and 2024 will set new records for all-time hottest years globally. A new study calculates that El Nino impacts are actually far costlier than experts had thought, averaging trillions of dollars in long-term damage, forcing communities to divert resources to fund recovery and rebuilding.
Well, maybe this isn't the time to lecture people on climate change, Des.
NOAA also announced that levels of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere increased to a new record high in May, jumping at one of the fastest rates ever recorded, hitting 423 parts per million at Hawaii's Mauna Loa Observatory. Quote, continuing a steady climb further into territory not seen in millions of years.
And we were worried that it would ever reach 400?
Yeah. In Philadelphia, an elevated section of Interstate 95, one of the region's busiest highways, collapsed early Sunday morning after a truck hauling gasoline overturned and ignited underneath it. The truck driver was killed. The National Transportation and Safety Board is on scene investigating. Pennsylvania's Governor Josh Shapiro issued a disaster declaration speeding up federal funding for repairs. He warned reconstruction of the highway is expected to disrupt transportation for months. And I'll just note here that the adoption of electric vehicles will help take explosive trucks off the U.S. highways. In accountability news, three manufacturers of toxic PFAS forever chemicals have agreed to pay more than $1 billion to settle the first wave of lawsuits alleging the chemical companies contaminated drinking water across the country.
That's good, but not enough.
The settlement came after multiple investigative reports revealed secret industry documents showing exactly how manufacturers DuPont and 3M knew decades ago that their PFAS forever chemicals were a danger to human health, but publicly insisted the chemicals were safe and purposely distorted public knowledge about PFAS in their products. A new study from UC San Francisco details how, quote, the chemical industry used the tactics of the tobacco industry to delay public awareness of the toxicity of PFAS and, in turn, delayed regulations governing their use.
Well, we got to have our Teflon pans.
Over the last 2 weeks, more than two dozen states have filed suit against PFAS manufacturers to pay for the mounting costs of cleanup of the chemicals, which are now ubiquitous in the population and environment. Here's Maine's Attorney General Aaron Fry on CNBC.
3M and DuPont created these chemicals, had the science that showed just how dangerous they were, how toxic they were, how they were going to last forever. It is my responsibility to do whatever I can to hold accountable those companies that profited off of this chemical.
Good. Yeah, go get them.
And finally, some good news in Minnesota. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has revoked a crucial permit for a controversial proposed copper and nickel mine in the northeastern part of the state, concluding the permit did not comply with water quality standards set by a sovereign downstream tribe.
A lot of good news coming out of Minnesota these days. Wait a minute. Isn't 3M based in Minnesota?
Yes.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
But nothing lasts forever, so they say.
So they say.
So they say. Unless it's PFAS chemicals, and then they do.
Thank you very much, our producer, Desi Doyen. My thanks to our guests today, Heather Digby-Parton of Salon and Hullabaloo, and Keith Barber of Daily Coast, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us.
That was kind of fun.
It was kind of fun.
Kind of fun. Very serious stuff, but still kind of fun to talk about it.
Always
with
greatly appreciated to have you here. If you missed any portion of today's special coverage or any other program we've ever done, you can always download all of them for free at bradblog.com. No paywall. That is made possible by those of you who have been kind enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate to subscribe to our program and our blog for any amount you like. All of it is greatly appreciated and, as ever, much needed, especially now. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Twitters, and Mastodons, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
But nothing-